Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
Good evening, everybody. My name is David Wright. I'm a librarian here with Seattle Public Library. Welcome to the Central Library, and thank you for joining us for an evening with William Volman reading from The Dying Grass. I'd like to thank the Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present this evening. I'd like to thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support of library programs, also our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and the Seattle Public Library Foundation. William Volman is no doubt known to many of you who may have attended other events with Elliott Bay Books in the past. For anyone here tonight who is not already familiar with this author's work, William Volman is the prolific author of a wide range of extraordinary and highly original works, fiction and nonfiction, for which he has received widespread critical acclaim and awards, including the National Book Award for his 2005 novel, Europe Central. The book we're hearing about tonight, The Dying Grass, a novel of the Nez Perce War, is the long-awaited fifth entry in Volman's projected seven-novel Dreams sequence, exploring collisions between Europeans and indigenous Americans across the ages, about which he is infinitely better suited to tell you than I. I will just say a few things about The Dying Grass. The book is brilliant, astonishing, profound, haunting, and I strongly suspect unforgettable. We are so glad to have you here with us at the library, ladies and gentlemen. William Volman.
Well, thank you all for coming. I will do my best. Now, the first and most important item of business I have is that I don't know where we're all going to go out and have a drink afterward. So, you folks figure it out and let everyone know, then that is where we will go. This book is meant to be seen on the page. A certain amount is going to be lost as I read it, and I'm sorry for that. That's just how it is. I'll try to read it as carefully as I can. The other thing I would want to say is that the Nez Perce War, like all the Indian wars, was a race war. And all the economic and other reasons for it were expressed through the filter of race. And that means that 19th century Anglo-Americans used a lot of terms to describe other people that are now considered very offensive. I will be using some of those terms because they did, that's just how it is. And if you listen to those terms and you think about them, you can see why people might have wanted to use them. It's a lot easier, to call an Indian a red, an Afro-American a nigger, just like nowadays I know people who call Muslims ragheads. So there you have it. So this first part I sort of cobbled together a lot of short excerpts about the outbreak of the war. His hounds bark, and the old man sits up, reaching under the pillow for the revolver. But Swan Necklace's plump young face rises in the window like a moon. Get him, Butch. Get him, Jupiter. But even as the face gloats at him, he hears his squealing brutes clubbed down. "Why, you no good Indian bastard. I'll pay you back for that. And after I get you, I'll pin down your squaws." But that proud mouth almost seems to smile, even though its corners turn down. "By God, I should have known better than to leave the shutter ajar, no matter how hot it was. Holy Jesus, help me now. If I can just..." Because although the revolver is charged, the instant it flashes into sight, the sweet summer sky, yellow gold, and the river singing, 2 seconds is all I need of sky and this house whose beams I hewed out with hope and sweat, for thine is the kingdom. And if I try for my buffalo gun, not even a foot away, right there leaning up against the wall, that's 2 seconds, maybe three, but if I miss the sky, it'll have to be the revolver. One into his face and then, but I can buy them off. That's it, I know, I knew. I always knew the evil of them Indians. There must be one more of them outside at least, because they're such goddamn cowards. And in the intruder's pale brown hands, a sharps now gleams dark, rising. I got to do it right now. "Hey, you Indians, I didn't do nothing." So if I stare right into his cruel eyes and at his forehead, which sweat shines like his many, many necklaces as the rifle speaks. "My God, you've shot me, you damned Indian. Help, these Indians are murdering me." And then the rifle speaks again into his face. So, he who killed Dakupin is dead, just as we would have it. My heart flies up to the sun. Bloody and silver-haired on his bearskin pillow, a fly circling round his open mouth, here in this place which the Bostons have stolen for themselves along with so many others, gashing our mother, uprooting her hair, shooting Dakupin, a crippled woman without harm in her. Thus we have punished him. We are laughing and making ourselves brave. We who are from sparse snowed place and Wallowa. So we give ourselves his guns, tear apart his Bible, rend the silver dollars from his pockets, scalp him, take his bullets, powder, sugar, coffee, and getting drunk liquid, discussing our troubles round and round. Because Cut Arm showed the rifle, and these Bostons mean to suck the marrow from our bones. Hear me. These Bostons here on this land, they have painted away from us. Exactly these are the ones who signed the paper to the grandfather in Washington to get us removed. If I am to speak, I shall now speak from my heart. Dakupin's spirit may then be gladdened. Let us ride to tell Tuhuhulzote, whom Cut Arm has shamed. No, brother. This has been no more glorious than washing the ashes off Sweat House rocks. That old man showed no fight. Let us continue straightforwardly in the way that we used to live. Looking Glass and White Bird acted thus before they got old. We shall be praised. Let us ride quickly to some other place and kill more Bostons, completing our hearts. We shall kill them like grizzly bears. We shall rush toward their blood. And staking out their horses in another bad Boston's wheat field in order to lure him out. Because last year, in this place, a certain tall Boston, for his own amusement, took up his black snake whip and lashed two of our young men whom he had never seen before. And when Ollicott complained at Butterfly Place, the Bostons called a council to judge who was in the wrong. And this very man, who now plants wheat in our country, wounding the flesh of our mother, sat on the council and decided the tall Boston was in the right. And he, this one here, he who was also the one who with his friend murdered Shore Crossing's father, said he should not be prosecuted for killing a dog. They hide on the field's edge in the growing yellow grass. Over them, the yellow and crimson emblem of a red-winged blackbird. Until two Bostons come running to curse them, the sun falling, as the one who judged against the people now sees a rifle rising up out of the grass, shouts, strikes his brother's arm, and back they run. But Swan Necklace stands up smiling, with his Wyakin riding him to full dusk, and Red Moccasin Tops leaks out singing, while Shore Crossing takes aim. This is nothing, far less trouble than running down a wild Mustang, so that they kill those two dogs. Ah ha ha. The moon is yellow-white as an old horse's tongue, and blood darker than Salish cherries. Ready to hear the purport of their visitor's heart, he stands behind Ollicott. There on the far side of Buzzard Mountain, where the wind blows cool, as two moons, that good warrior well known, canters up on his mouse-colored horse, the women squinting anxiously through the smoke of the roasting meat. His dear daughter, sound of running feet, a modest girl who makes few errors, Ollicott's younger wife, Cloudburst, and the half-woman, Wellweyus, Fairland, who is Ollicott's other wife, having stayed with good woman at Split Rock to help springtime give birth, all turning their darkening ribbons of beef on green sticks. And John Wilson and Half Moon, they who are fishing skilled, have just run up from the creek when Two Moons leaps down, caressing the horse's neck, and says, "Some young men have gone to war." At which Hainmot Tuyalakekt, he who is called Joseph, smiles painfully, his heart screaming, "Quo, quo, quo," like a raven, as Wellweyus's hand goes to her throat. And Two Moons, whose blanket has been folded over his left arm, now draws it in tightly around his waist, left hand separated from right by a single thickness of wool cloth, standing large-eyed, waiting to hear what the brother chiefs will say. Hainma Tuyalakekt hides his heart, while Ollicott seems nearly glad. They leave most of the hides to rot, the men and Wellweyus slinging their rifles over their shoulders as the daughter and the brother's younger wife finish cinching bags of meat upon their 12 pack horses, with carrion birds already blackly clouded on the cow guts. And now the men are riding ahead, John Wilson carrying smoked trout for his sister, murmuring a secret prayer to his Wyakin, "I am flying up." Two Moons cantering beside Ollicott, wondering how it is going to be. Half Moon watching the horizon for something bad. Hainma Tuyalakekt, already half bewitched by Cut Arm's angry face, which floats before him in the air. As for Ollicott, he hates Cut Arm worse than Sitting Bull. But Wellweyus canters, singing and laughing as if she does not understand. Perhaps she is making herself brave. So again, they cross the roaring Chinook salmon water, raising their rifles high while their fine horses swim them from bank to bank. Unspeaking they ride, their hearts as various as those of gamblers playing the stick game. Back to Split Rock, from where so many people have already fled, panic women whipping their horses' heads, leaving dog dung, dead circles of grass, open pits, steaming hillocks within which Camus sweats for nothing. But White Thunder, this excellent young man soon to become great, is waiting on his uncles. He has painted his face, and our buffalo hunters are beginning to ride in from the low trail, while White Bird sings one of the oldest dreamer songs. All people, all animals, our mother will die, the buffalo will perish, our liberty broken. The sun, glaring down on the white gorgeted chests of our warriors who dance by the lake's edge, each knot in their dark braids picked out with its own white jewel of light. Light on their round shell disc earrings, the stripes of their blankets and the rectangles and diamonds of their leggings glowing whiter than the whites of their well-shaded eyes. To them, Hainmot Tuyalakekt says, "I am weary of your conduct. Soon you will be sorry for what you have done. There is no remedy now." While Tuhuhulzote's wives, obeying their master, keep on digging, steaming, pounding, and smoking camas, and his nephew's dry arrow shafts, some young men ecstatically beating an untanned elk skin, singing war songs as fair land makes soup for everyone. White Bird rides his horse round and round, saying, "Now we shall not go on the reservation." Where is Looking Glass? He took his people away. They have been gone 2 days. To their reservation, at which Tuhuhulzote snarls, "If they conclude to become slaves of Cutarm and the Bostons forever, I cannot help it." Good Woman crawls out from the teepee, wearing many beads. "Is it well with springtime?" "Very well, and you have another daughter. They are sleeping in the women's house." "Good, and my thanks to you and fair land. Soon we must be riding away." White Thunder waits to come to him. They sit down together to smoke kinnikinnick, watching blackbirds on the lake, the locust singing tick, 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 until he says, "Now tell me, did you ride with these young men?" "No. Uncle, you know that I have always opened my ears to your words." "I am glad. Who were they?" "Only one from our band." "Shall I guess?" "Geese, three times alighting on water." "So I supposed. My dear nephew, he has done wrong." "What will you say to him?" "Nothing now. Who gave him a rifle?" "My dear uncle, his heart had grown angered, so he rode to that place with only bow and arrow." And then White Thunder begins to relate who went killing and which Bostons died, how it began, and what the first three killers, Swan Necklace, Shore Crossing, and Red Moccasin Tops, have said, when Looking Glass rode away, and what rose up in people's hearts when Tuhuhulzote then set out alongside his fiercest men and White Bird's best killers, and geese three times alighting on water. They have now raped women and attacked children. So that he well perceives that this nephew of his has grown thirsty to kill Bostons. But to think on our young men, even geese three times alighting on water, who is bad and undeserving, and these meanly grinning warriors of White Birds and Tuhuhulzotes, who have now gotten even with the Bostons. Shore Crossing proud that all the people now know what we have done. Raising their lances, riding necklaced and braided, bearing quivers and a few old Henry rifles against the great wheeled guns of the Bluecoats. How could they not see what will happen? To consider the Bluecoats revenging themselves on our women and children, this wounds his heart. Cutarm will be killing us all. Such is Cutarm, who pretends to be as kind as a grandfather. So, Heinma Tuyalakekt meets his baby girl. His three women looking up at him. Good Woman, picking nits from springtime's hair, believing that he will act rightly. Sound of running feet, so pleased with her new sister that she wishes she herself could have made her. Springtime, sitting straight and still, hoping to bring him joy by doing other brave things. He gives them each a fine copper bracelet. Taking the baby in his arms, he says, "My youngest one, you are strong. Soon you will be as high as spring grass." "Mr. Shearer, is this country still familiar to you?" "To be honest, Colonel, Mr. Chapman knows this section better than I. He's had more truck with the engines here on account his wife is one of them." "Takes all kinds, don't it? Where's Mr. Chapman?" "Right here." "Mr. Chapman, what's in it for you?"
"What do you mean?"
"Since you're one of those squaw men." "Those are fighting words, Colonel." "All the same, there's no reason for you and me to fight, as long as you're on the side of the United States."
"I said I am. Now have you picked on me enough?"
"Is your Mrs. Chapman a full blood?"
"She's Umatilla, without any Nez Perce in her, and I won't see her insulted by you. And furthermore, these Nez Perces causing all the trouble, I can whip them single-handed, because they're nothing but yellow-bellied cowards." You put her away, didn't you? What's that to you? Got tired of being a squaw man. Now I'll get you. Mr. Chapman, is this the rise you were talking about? Sure is. That's Whitebird Canyon down there. La Mata, they call it. Now, where my ranch is, you can't see it on account of the buttes. I don't give two shits about your ranch. Where are the Reds? Colonel, they're sure to be along the creek, that-a-way. Good. The men can stand down now. 3 hours sleep until dawn. In the cool dark, the dark, the dark, as dark and tightly twined as an Indian berry basket. Yes, sir. And the blue night sky, beneath which Blackie dreams of Fidelia, while Cash, that refugee from a sheet metal factory in Cleveland, dreams about Lynn Bowers, empress of his fancy. Tonight she is bare-breasted like an Apache squaw, because once upon a time he had to do with the sharpened bone plug set just beneath the lower lip of a married Apache woman, a harlot who showed him no dislike. And oh, the straight bangs of her, my adorable Apache gal. I'd have to say she was kind, even if she did give me the loos. Now for Lynn Bowers, with her straight-cut chestnut hair and her blue eyes and the bone plug under her lip, and picture windows for Fidelia. That's Blackie's dream. And a bush silhouetted against the ridgetop, then three more to the south, the stars surprisingly white in the hazy night. Then all the trees are overhead and against and around the men like the night itself. Perry and Theller sit mostly silent together against a boulder with their carbines behind them. Theller begins to snore, then starts awake. How long did I sleep, Colonel? Oh, less than 5 minutes. Want to smoke? Sure. Thank you, sir. Well, another adventure. Theller, you know what I think? What's that, sir? By the way, that's a fine draw of tobacco you gave me. Two Huhulzote is the bad one. Joseph's just a girly young Injun. Once we nab him, he'll do whatever we say. Alicat's a villain, but we can take care of him anytime. We've got Looking Glass, Whitebird, and those others good and beaten down. But Two Huhulzote, Jesus God, did you see the look in his eye when me and the general laid hands on him at Lapwai? I sure did, Colonel. And after we locked him up, you know what the general said to me? Something about his evil, glittering gaze or some such. Yes, sir, our general's full of fancies. Well, what was your impression? Of Two Huhulzote, sir? Nowhere near as fearsome as a Modoc. That was some campaign, wasn't it? You remember the party we had after Captain Jack was finally hanged? How those ranchers' daughters could dance. Not as well as Captain Jack. Now there, sir, was one of the worst Indian monsters that ever haunted this earth. Oh, and those lava beds and that cursed creeping fog and that Lieutenant Colonel Wheaton was a damned fucking... A real heroic expedition, sir. Every now and then I entertain myself by telling it over to Delia until she gets the shivers. After which you comfort her, I'll bet. Well, sir, I do my best. Anyway, Theller, that's how it seems to me. Two Huhulzote is the root of all this trouble. Joseph's just his pawn. We need to get that old growler and fix him, right, Colonel? Just don't let the general hear about it. He's squeamish. That's for sure. Sir, if you want to shut your eyes for a bit, I'll keep a watch. Thanks, Theller, but you know I can never sleep before action. Get a bit sick to my stomach, as you may remember. You were always as cool as ice. I'm just a fool for excitement, Colonel. Delia always says, Colonel, sir, the volunteers are drinking. So what? They're drinking a lot. Tell Chapman to come here, not Shearer. Yes, sir. Mr. Chapman, are you and your men such goddamn fools as to get drunk a couple of hours before a battle? We can hold our liquor, Colonel. I know these boys just like, oh, fuck off. Crawl away under that sissy hat of yours. Go diddle your redskin wife. What the hell did you come here for? Colonel, I'll put in a complaint against you. Don't think I won't. Go to blazes, damn squaw man. Colonel, sir, the scouts are raring to go. They say, you hear that, feller? Yes, sir. Better ride out. Yes, sir. The eastern horizon, as white as the parting of a Nez Perce woman's black, black hair. Feller exultant, loving his horse, proud of his command, knowing his Springfield right down to Worm and Tompion, vanished ahead with his squad of six. And dawn, the men counting off their 100 rounds from the saddlebags, filling their belt loops and pockets, swigging out the cylinders of their Colt 450s. Load with cartridges, load. And double columns now. Company F, move out. Engines and volunteers on flank. Yes, sir. All right, boys. And a pale cloud in the saddle of the dark ridge behind Whitebird Creek. The crickets loud in the cool bushes. The water deeper than shadow, more invisible than the night itself. But one can smell it above and below the stink of cavalry sweat. Company H, move out. Yes, sir. Move out. Just as Umatillas will make American coins, independence, blankets into dresses, so our cavalry must now change these outlaws into good Indians. And from far away rise the little drum sounds of their coming, pim, 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 and the door of the morning is almost opened. Whitebird Canyon, and down that stony canyon road, help me. You hear that? Help me, please. Companies, halt. Ma'am, who the hell are you? A pale little body, ain't she? Mrs. Isabella Benedict is my name. These are my two youngest children. The Indians killed my husband, having first shot him through both legs, an injury which their neighbor Hurdy-Gurdy Brown pronounced susceptible to the cold water cure. And then while they waited for the Nez Perces to come back, Isabella, scrubbing the floor, which had kept splintering the youngest feet, heard a noise, and staring out into the bright green summer rectangle of hot, humid light, saw nothing, but here came the sound of footsteps in dry glass. Schluck, schluck. He never did them any harm. All he was doing, I swear, was making sure the cows were all right. I'll never throughout my days forget those first three gunshots, but first we kept waiting and praying, hoping the other miners would return in time with their weapons. And then when I went to pick onions from their garden, I saw them for real, and Samuel told us to run for it, and God bless us because he couldn't run no more. And we couldn't hardly bear to leave him, but Mr. Bacon promised to stand by him, and Samuel said to me, Bella, think on our little ones, and may the Lord protect you. So I took the girls by the hand, and we started running out the back gate, but the Nez Perces were already homing in on us, so we had to come creeping back. And Samuel had already crawled away out the window, leaving a trail of blood like a dying deer, and we never saw him anymore. Then came those three shots, and Mr. Bacon falling down on his back, and the faces in the window. Oh, my God, those hateful Indian eyes. Give them some rations. Yes, sir. Poor lady. Mr. Chapman, do you know these individuals? Sure do, neighbor. Now, Mrs. Benedict, ma'am, where do these Indians go? Down there toward the creek. And Mr. Bacon and Mr. Baker, they're all lying dead. Oh, Jesus, oh, Jesus. I witnessed what they did to Mr. Devine. And the Indians, their faces rose up in the window, and then the baby. What about Mrs. Manuel? Have you seen her? Oh, Jesus. How many Indians, Mrs. Benedict? Hundreds and hundreds. Oh, dear Jesus. Who's in charge? Is it Joseph? I don't know. My God, they're all on the warpath. And when I pled for my children's life, they let you go, looks like. Was it Joseph? You knew them? Here's a blanket, ma'am. Your troubles are finished. You just sit there and wait. We'll be back to take care of you just as soon as we've whooped them. Don't go down there, I pray you. You just wait on us. No. All right, now, just take a rest here, ma'am. Don't go. Oh, dear Jesus. Companies, move out. Volunteers on flank. Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be. Yes, sir. Oh, that sad lady and them poor little children. It would make your heart ache to see the little children hereabouts that never cry except when you say the word Indians. Well, all them bad times are coming to an end today. Stand up for these, the wronged, the aggrieved. They carried off Jack Manuel's wife. Never did hear from her again. In deepest pits of darkness found. Tell us anything we haven't heard, sport. Of heaven's most sacred gifts bereaved. Oh, you fucking. The tasked, the scourged, in fetters bound. For all we know, she's safe at Slate Creek. You never met Jack Manuel, much less his wife. Mr. Joe shot her in cold blood and then burned her in her house. That's what the little Manuel girl said, and she... Then why don't that Mrs. Benedict know nothing about it? I'd rather hear from Lynn Bowers. It was Linda Bowers. Lynn. And they mutilated that other fellow. You told us that a dozen times. That's Whitebird Creek way down there and the salmon's way past it. The gorge softer than Hell's Canyon, but still wide and deep enough to give birth to any story and a smell of water from the darkness. I can't see nothing. Mr. Chapman, what kind of country lies down yonder? Well, Lieutenant, the Indians call it Hikisie, which means a wrinkled country. I'll wager his red bitch taught him that word. Careful, Lieutenant told us not to. To hell with the Lieutenant and his mother. So you're saying it's rough. Got that right. It's, damn, what's that noise? A coyote. Never heard no coyote go on quite like that. Bring me a scout. I don't know why these scouts never report. Sir, I know. Getting good and bright now. Yes, it is. Like our lust for Indian horses. They're in a fix now, boys. We'll have fine plunging fire because this here's what they call a key position. Oh, fuck you and your education. And look, before you shoot, in case we can save Mrs. Manuel, Chapman says her place is down about there. He ought to know. I'd say he loves women all right. Lieutenant Theller. Yes, sir. What did you find on your scout? All quiet, sir. You have the best eyes of any officer. What can you see beyond the river? Well, sir, a succession of steeps with pointed or rounded tops. Take your time. Use the field glass. Snowy peaks far away and the Salmon River hiding behind the horizon. What's all that down there, sir? Horses, sir. More than I can count. Then where are the hostiles? Is that smoke down there? Where are the hell are them scouts? That must be their camp, maybe 4 miles down, gazing down into the green trees along the creek where the many pallid teepees glow like dawn clouds. And to the east, too bright in the morning sun, side canyons like parallel green chevrons in the yellow-green and gray slope along the creek. Thank you very much. Oh, thank you so much, sir. That was the first time that I really tried to read many pages aloud from that, and I hope it's not too confusing. You know, this has a cast of many, many characters and many voices, and hopefully, you know, you got a sense of some of the voices, even if it wasn't all clear. If anyone has any questions, I'm right here. Yes. Well, for the cavalry, there were all kinds of memoirs of the Indian fighting army from that decade. So I read as many of them as I could, and there were certain turns of phrase, you know, that the people used. So I kind of built a little library of those. I read some military manuals, so I understood, you know, who would order who to do what, you know, how many people would be in a squad and things like that. And I began to get it. And then the other piece of the picture was that during the Modoc War, there was a British officer who visited the American Army, and he was horrified and disgusted at how foul-mouthed they were. And, of course, none of that stuff appears in the period literature. But I thought, well,
if they're swearing like contemporary sailors and throw in a little bit of racist, sexist garbage here and there, it might do the trick, you know? And for the Indian voices, there are some first-person Nez Perce accounts, but the Nez Perce, didn't speak English as a first language. So a lot of it is in a kind of pidgin English. And I thought, they wouldn't speak to each other, in this cigar story Indian English. There's a dictionary of Nez Perce written by a linguist named Aoki. So I read the dictionary from cover to cover and got all kinds of words, and many of their words are sentences. So one word might be, she is gathering grass for bedding. So I thought, okay, all right. So every time the Nez Perce camp, I've got to remember to send some of the women to go out and gather grass for bedding, that's sort of what I did. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, I visited all of them. Have you been on the Nez Perce Trail yourself? It's really gorgeous, and many parts of it are quite similar to the way it must have been in 1877. So Whitebird Canyon I went there 3 or 4 times. Every time it was deserted, and I think it looks exactly the way it did. You can walk around the battlefield, and you can see, okay, so this is where Lieutenant Theller was killed. This is where Ollicott came up. This is where the people were in their valley. It all makes sense when you see it. And it's really an amazing place. I haven't been, to the former Indian territory in Oklahoma where the Nez Perce were settled. Yes. Well, I wanted it to be about landscapes. And originally I thought I'd have a middle column for the landscapes and then a left and right column for different people talking. And that seemed to box me in too much. So I came up with a series of indented paragraphs to represent different things going on. So like in the part that I read, Mrs. Benedict is kind of upset and talking about what happened to her. And then it's indented where it's in the third person about her, where she's sort of remembering what happened in the past tense. It took me a while to work that out. And I tried to make it different from the other 7 dreams. I figure, since the story is always the same, the Indians get screwed. So at least I can try to write it differently. Yes. Well, the original plan was that General Sherman wanted to hang and possibly exterminate them, as many as possible. And eventually, when Joseph finally surrendered, General Miles, who was the one who actually captured him, gave him a promise that he would be returned to his reservation. But General Howard, who was the superior officer, and Sherman, who was Howard's superior officer, thought that the non-treaty Nez Perces must be punished for the war. And they sent them off to the Indian Territory, and the plan was to never let them come back. But they weren't used to the climate, something like half of them died very, very quickly of malaria and other diseases. And finally, when everybody was just kind of broken and they didn't pose a threat anymore, they were allowed to come back. But they had to declare whether they would be Christian or non-Christian. And the Christians went to a somewhat better reservation. They were boxcarred out there as far as Fort Leavenworth, and I think a little farther. And then they had to go on wagons. And when they came back, I think they were actually required to pay their own way. not really. I would have liked to. There's so much about it. But I decided to focus, you know, on these few months not even go back too much even into the previous relations between the Nez Perce and the Anglo-Americans. It's just such a vast subject. Yes. Well, there are two left now, and you know, I want to let some time go by so they won't be, you know, at all like this one. I'll write a few other books, and also, you know, it's kind of depressing writing these things. So, yes. When I was maybe 10 or 11, you know, back in the days when I still watched television, I watched it with my parents, and there was some kind of documentary about Chief Joseph, you know, and the whole "I will fight no more forever." I thought, oh, you know, what beautiful poetry, and oh, and he whipped the cavalry, and the battles are still taught in West Point. And, you know, it turns out that that stuff is not quite accurate. Chief Joseph was not a war chief. It was the other chiefs who succeeded. And then this speech of his, it was uttered in Nez Perce, and that Ad Chapman was the interpreter. No one wrote it down. So someone else with a poetic temperament reconstructed it decades later. But it's a very powerful story, and in a way, it's all the more touching to me that Joseph was not what they call the Red Napoleon. He was someone who cared about the women and children and stayed with them at the end when he could have escaped. Yeah, he's the kind of person I would have liked to be, I think. Yes. Well, the great thing about writing The Seven Dreams is the story is already known. So all I had to do, the hard part was figuring out when the Indian voice would take over and when the white voice would take over, and I tried to avoid having too much overlap. I figured that would be tedious for people. So it sort of switches back and forth. All I really needed to do was read detailed accounts of the war to say, all right, well, this happened on this day and this happened on this day, and then, you know, what do we want to show? Like, one thing is we want to show Chief Joseph growing as a person, becoming more and more brave and selfless and more respected. And we also want to show General Howard, who was a well-meaning guy doing bad things, getting more broken down, and so on and so forth. Yes. Well, let's see. The one I'm going to finish first, it's a nonfiction book. It's called Carbon Ideologies, and it's all about oil, natural gas, coal, fracking, compared to nuclear power. And I'm just trying to talk to people in these areas that have it and make it and use it and say, you know, what do you think about this energy form? What do you think about global warming? So that book is getting close to finished. And then there are two other novels coming along after that, one short one and one longer one. Yes. I've talked to a couple of people on one of the reservations, I haven't gone to any tribal historian. I figured that I wanted to do things my way, and I thought it would be so easy to hurt somebody, you know, someone who hears words like squaw and reds. And I thought, you know, why even get into it? That means that the book lacks a certain dimension. I decided to do it that way, and so far I have no regrets. Yes. Lewis and Clark believed that the Nez Perce were the most hospitable and ethical of any of the tribes they met. You know, they like to rank people, you know. Clark had an affair with a Nez Perce woman who gave birth to a boy. He actually survived to be taken into captivity. He was an old man, and he sometimes could make a little bit of money by saying, you know, I am Clark. And people were quite disgusted, you know, at him, disgusted at Clark for miscegenation. The other thing that the army seemed to remember about that time with the Nez Perce is that, you know, they were very proud, particularly Looking Glass's grandfather, of having given Lewis and Clark a horse. And they thought that this sort of made them brothers, you know. And they were, you know, the army then was saying, oh, you know, they go on and on something about, you know, giving them a horse. They never stop talking about it, you know. Who gives a rat's ass about it? I'm going to sit here, and if anyone figures out where is a watering hole and lets everyone know, I will be there. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.